A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Thea is wandering about the British countryside, no doubt sneering at the dairy produce contained therein. So I'm delighted to be joined by arts editor, opera singer and quondam indie pop star Lucy Dallas.
Hello.
Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
Lucy, you've got such a starry pedigree that only last week a major figure in television comedy messaged me to recall the day he spent with you and your band at Abbey Road Studios, which is the studios of the Beatles.
Yes,
it was. And he remembered it fondly.
Yeah.
So when I'm making these jokes about you being an indie pop star and everyone's saying it's just him being a swear word of choice, it's not, is it? You were genuinely an indie pop star?
I think pop star is an ambitious term.
How would you describe it? How would you describe it?
I made some music that was released publicly.
And it did quite well?
Not that well.
What was the
band
called?
We had a good time.
What was the band called?
The Impossibles.
The Impossibles. And you are on YouTube?
No, we're not on YouTube, no.
You are on YouTube.
We're not on YouTube.
So if anyone is interested in Lucy Dallas' band, The Impossibles,
please
go on to YouTube.
Actually, there's loads of bands called The Impossibles. There's a lot of 60s garage bands called The Impossibles,
really?
So you won't be able to tell.
Okay, so if you put in The Impossibles, the song about the drum, what's the title?
The drum.
The drum, right. So if we put The Impossibles, the drum, our producer Matt is nodding. He's about to do it now. In fact, he is doing it on
Please
his computer as we speak.
Please nobody feel they have to do this.
Please do that. But also, Lucy, among your many other talents, you're a fluent French speaker, so you can be honorary pronunciation guru in our conversation about Macron. Macron?
That's yeah, fine. It depends how French you want to go, but that's
can
lovely.
You say it.
You can say Macron or Macron.
Macron.
Or
I can't, yeah, Macron. No, I sound silly.
No, that's lovely. You don't sound silly.
Okay. Make sure you're following this podcast on Twitter at @FBFM_podcast. And please do review it on iTunes. I've noticed we have had a couple of new reviews recently, but not enough to sate our insatiable appetite there. If you want to subscribe to the TLS, Google TLS subscriptions and type pod1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. Coming up on the show this week, Vive la Révolution! And what a peculiar revolution it has proven to be. The winner of the French election is a 39-year-old ex-banker who has ridden a populist yet centrist movement from nowhere to defeat blonde bogey figure and notable fascist Marine Le Pen. How, why and what does it mean are all legitimate questions that now follow. Joining us on the back of a piece written fresh for the TLS this week to answer them is the incomparable Sudhir Hazara Singh. We also have a fiction special of the TLS this week, which includes excellent pieces on some problems with fantasy fiction, including a rare knock on Angela Carter, and the never-ending rise of Nordic noir. Toby Lichtig, the TLS fiction editor, will be on hand to discuss all this, and his own review of Jez Butterworth's The Ferryman. Continuing matters theatrical, we will also be joined in the studio by Hal Jensen, who has reviewed Angels in America this week. To France, then, where we have seen a landslide victory for Emmanuel Macron, winning around 2/3 of the vote and defeating soft-voiced fascist Marine Le Pen. So what's significant about this? Well, it's a very pro-EU vote. Macron walked to his victory speech to the strains of Ode to Joy, the EU anthem. It's a vote for centrism, which looked like it was going out of fashion. Brexit and Trump, we have been told, was a rejection of orthodoxy of previous attempts to hold the middle ground. Well, the centre has held in France, as it did in Holland, as it will probably do in Germany. It is still, however, a vote against the status quo. Macron's movement En Marche was founded scarcely a couple of years ago. He has no traditional political party. Although it's worth noting that political parties in France have no great long-standing histories. The Front National was a creation of the 70s, for example. But he's talking the language of change. And it doesn't mean that the far right has been routed. Le Pen called her vote historic and massive, and the election does indicate that around a third of the voting French public, with a healthy crop of youngsters at its heart, would have countenanced a fascist as president. It's a fascinating moment in European history. And to tell us more is Sudhir Hazare, a singer who spent the last few weeks in Paris and has written about his impressions of what has happened, what will happen next for the TLS this week. He joins Lucy and me now. Sudhir, this was the expected victory. The favourite has triumphed in clear terms. Why do you think this is still a notable result?
Well, Macron has basically, I mean, independently of what happens now to his presidency, he's already rewritten the basic rules of French politics. You have to go back to Napoleon to have an executive leader who's so young. Also, he's somebody who traditionally a French president has to have a kind of strong local base in order to be even competitive for the election. And Macron didn't have one. He didn't have a party, a kind of mainstream party behind him. He has no extensive experience in cabinet. And he comes from the center, which, you know, traditionally in France is kind of the Bermuda Triangle of French politics. And there have been many attempts before to try and put together the kind of coalition that he's aspiring to gather. And so for all these reasons, he's actually managed really a very spectacular breakthrough, and things will never be quite the same.
And what conclusions can we draw about the state of France? You make the point very eloquently in the piece that in some ways this is a, I suppose, an existential French election. It's an election where French philosophy, the philosophy of how, what sort of nation they want to be.
They're always existential.
I know they're always existential. Election. But this one particularly, so you feel, what can we learn about the French psyche as it currently is as a result of this?
Well, I think the face-off between Macron and Marine Le Pen on the second round was really a face-off between the sort of optimistic France, which Macron stands for, which is the sort of open, buoyant, outward-looking country, definitely seeing France as being part of a wider European project. And on the other hand, the more defensive, anxious, pessimistic France, which in many respects Marine Le Pen represents. And the comforting thing that comes out of the election is that a majority of French people are willing to identify themselves with this more optimistic, buoyant vision that Macron represents.
I was interested also, Sudhir, in your piece. You were talking about there's all sorts of binary oppositions because they're the kind of great nation of binary opposition. But especially there was a geographical one that I wasn't really aware of.
Well, it's sort of double contrast. On the one hand, basically all the territories in the northeast, east and the southeast are the territories which are essentially the sort of deindustrialized parts of France. And they're the ones that are turning increasingly now to the Front National. And Macron stands for the sort of newly industrialized parts of the country in the west and in the southwest, where the economy is growing, where the rate of unemployment is much lower. And added to that, there's an urban-rural division. So within the same department, you may have massive Front National votes in the periphery and in the countryside. And in the towns, you have very strong levels of support for Macron. So the towns are basically supporting the pro-European, outward-looking candidate, and the countryside is turning increasingly to the Front National.
So in some ways, that's played out the same thing we have seen in Brexit, which was a very urban versus rural, southeast versus the rest of the country. We saw it in America with Trump. You know, you're talking about Rust Belt equivalences in France, are you not? So in some ways, despite it being a resounding vote for a centrist and a resounding vote for that sort of pro-EU approach, we are still seeing the same patterns we've seen in Britain and America, perhaps.
Very similar in those respects. I mean, I think where the French are different is that now for at least 10 years, there's been this kind of existential debate about the future of the French nation. And that, I think, ties in with this kind of urban-rural divide, because most of the people who are voting Front National in the provinces and in rural France are also anxious about the future of France in an increasingly English-speaking world. So that's the kind of specific thing about France, that it's also a debate in part about the future of French identity, French culture. Although I think one of the good things about Macron is that he is not willing to kind of abandon that territory to the Front National, because he's also somebody who believes very passionately in the greatness of French culture, and he said that in his victory speech on Sunday.
Yes, and he's always, I mean, he quotes a lot of writers, doesn't he?
Yes.
They're not particularly kind of populist. It doesn't sound as though he's appealing to the people when he quotes them. He's not soundbiting them. He's kind of, and they're rather abstruse, some of them.
Yes, and that's what I wrote in the piece, that, you know, when you hear him, he very much gives you the impression of being a sort of old-fashioned Republican schoolteacher. And that's his kind of philosophy background. He's somebody who comes from a kind of very humanist tradition, and he passionately believes that part of the duty of public institutions is to create this kind of idea of a citizen who engages with the world of culture. And one of his proposals, now that he's president, is to give every 18-year-old a 500 euro culture pass, so that he or she can go and enjoy all the kind of great things that France has in terms of museums, art galleries.
Could I convince him to add a subscription to the TLS to that, do you think?
Yes, exactly.
I'm sensing a business opportunity here. Sort of.
Jumping in there, yeah, the commercial level. But that might also be, as well as promoting French culture, that may also be a very canny thing to do in terms of a rather nice way of saying we are all French, whatever our origins, because there has been, as we know, a lot of anti-Islamic, sort of anti-North African. She wasn't openly racist, was she, Marine Le Pen, while she was campaigning? But she was pretty near.
Pretty anti-Islamic, wasn't she?
Yeah, well, if you say specifically, this is for everybody who lives here, you know, I don't care what your name is or what your religion is or what your background is, these great monuments of culture are for you as well. That's not only a cultural thing to do, it's a political statement.
Exactly. And that's something that he also cares passionately about, the idea that, you know, with the exception of a very small minority of people, the vast majority of people of Islamic faith in France, he believes, are already integrated into the system, but they feel excluded, partly because unemployment levels in some of those areas are higher than the average, and he wants to draw them in.
But aren't we being too optimistic here, Sidhir? Because that problem, that's, so I don't know if you say sort of cancer at the heart of the body politic in France, that concern, that anger, we've seen playing out in these results. We're still talking about rural areas or southeastern areas, aren't we, who are anti that way of thinking. And although it's a landslide victory, more than a third of French people, many of them very young, have voted for a fascist.
French people who voted, because there was a high, fairly high.
And Abstention did very well. I get that. But do you know what I mean? That's not necessarily a cause for great celebration, is it?
Well, I mean, the level of the kind of protest vote has been high in France for some time now. And I think what Macron says to that is we have to address the reasons why people feel angry and are protesting. And if we're able to address those issues, the protest vote will go down. I mean, everything will rest, I think, on how quickly he's able to bring the level of unemployment down, right? I mean, unemployment now, I mean, it's not just this kind of 10% figure that one has to think about. It's that, you know, in the 18 to 25 group, it's like one in four people are unemployed. So everything is going to depend on how quickly he's able to turn that round. Some people think that he's not got enough by way. His economic policies are very kind of orthodox supply-side policies. So he wants to cut regulation, cut corporate tax, basically hand things over to the entrepreneurs and hope that they'll be able to grow the economy. But I'm not sure that that'll be enough.
And just finally, what about Le Pen? I mean, is there a narrative here? She's got 34% of the vote. She's going to, as demonstrated by the fact she stood aside as the president of Front National, she can completely rebrand this party. She can come back in 5 years' time, can't she? Is that the next step, that this party, this surge that could happen, could just be pushed back 5 years?
Well, they're caught in their contradiction as well, because she has, there's sort of two strategies that the FN is trying to follow. One is to try and pick up on the kind of discontented, disaffected working class vote, which is basically in the north and in the east of France. The other is to play very much the kind of anti-immigrant, anti-Islamic card. That's the FN of the south. And the FN hasn't really fundamentally decided which of those two strategies it wants to pursue. And trying to pursue both, as she did in 2017, doesn't work. So I think the future of the FN will depend on how it kind of faces up to that contradiction and which direction it decides to go in.
And meanwhile, the future of the EU has been resoundingly strengthened by this vote.
It's a reprieve.
Yes, absolutely. And Macron, you know, that's one of the great things, as you mentioned in your introduction. I mean, he makes no secret of the fact that he's a passionate European. And Britain will have to watch out too.
Well, we might leave it there then. On that note, Sudhir Hazarasinghe, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Before we go, Lucy, I want you to tell me the joke you heard on the radio about this French election.
Because
you were going to do it, and it made me smile.
It was it's not exactly a joke, but it was just a very nice way of formulating it, and I can't claim credit for this. But somebody said that it was playing out as a kind of Freudian election, in that it was the woman who killed her father against the man who married his mother. So there's a bit of highbrow pop psychology.
Yeah, very funny. What's interesting is we've got a couple of pieces. We've got Sudhir and we've also got Adam Thorpe, who's writing from a French village in the south. Mélenchon, both Sudhir and Adam. Mélenchon was a serious figure, wasn't he?
I mean, he felt like this
was silly communist.
No, I don't think so. And I think he was. I think a lot of people were actually very disappointed that clearly they were going to vote for Macron because they were not going to abstain, and they were obviously not going to vote for Marine Le Pen. But he, I mean, if we're being very kind of crude about it, he was the kind of Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, potentially. And people were very excited about him. And I think he's a very...
He did rather better than Corbyn's going to do, I think.
We'll see. But I think he's very charismatic and persuasive and had a lot of kind of momentum behind him. Not that sort of momentum, French momentum.
Proper momentum. The TLS, as it does occasionally, has a fiction special this week. The effervescent Claire Loudon has examined a farrago of fantasy fiction, if you'll excuse the alliteration, which all bear the marks of the fairy godmothers of the genre, Margaret Atwood and the super trendy Angela Carter. Loudon is a sceptic, both of the prevalence of lupine storylines, she believes the wolf as an image of wildness has been overexposed, and the quality of fantasy writing more generally, which can tend to the soppy and the sloppy. Keeping in the murderous gloom of Northern Europe, Heather O'Donoghue has considered the health of Nordic noir. She asks the pertinent question, what is it about these wealthy, egalitarian, socially secure states that has given rise to such a bleak and disturbing genre? The answer seems to be a combination of atmospheric landscape, political awareness, and Schadenfreude. The man who commissioned these investigations into genre writing is the fiction editor of the TLS, notable fan of Emma McBride, Toby Lichtig, who joins Lucy and me in the studio now. Toby, I've been mispronouncing your name now for a year.
Well,
and you kindly sent me this email saying, very gently and very politely saying, stop doing that. Is Toby Lichtig okay?
Yes, perfect. There's no very good way of pronouncing my name because I think it goes back to the Shtetl and it's probably Lichtig, but right. I think it got anglicised a while ago.
So it's Lichtig.
We'll stick with Lichtig.
Lichtig. Yeah. Well, I apologise for having previously got it wrong. Let's talk about fantasy fiction. I was very convinced by this argument by Claire Loudon. What does she have against it?
I think her real beef is specifically with fairy tales, with modern fairy tales that are no more than minor variations on the same old themes that we know from those fairy tales of yore from the 19th century and you know, far further back in time. And her main problem is that not enough is being done by a lot of these authors to update the tropes. So we have, you know, we have wolves, we have ravens, we have mirrors, we have forests and travelling circuses and dwarves and trapeze acts. And unless something new and interesting is being done with these ideas, then we're not really gaining anything. And why bother? And she's not saying it's not fair game to have a go, but I think like with any tropes that are well worn, you just have to work a bit harder. It's a bit like, you know, why write a Holocaust novel unless you can inject something new and interesting into it?
That's it. Well, I was taken by her claim that there's a connection between writing this sort of fiction and what she calls late career laziness, a sense that fairy tales are low hanging fruit. Because, like you, I've been a sort of jobbing fiction reviewer, and you do occasionally get, you know, I was thinking A.S. Byatt's Little Black Book of Stories, Mick Jackson's 10 Sorry Tales, or Neil Gaiman's The Ocean at the End of the Lane, and you get them as a reviewer. And you get to the end, you think, and it's kind of footling and fine,
But you get the question, why bother, is ever looming on your lips.
It is, and I do think it can be low-hanging fruit. But that said, there are some fantastic modern versions of fairy tales, and you can look at Helen Oyeyemi's written a very interesting collection. There was a wonderful collection a couple of years ago by a debut author called Angela Redman. And these people are doing different things with the genre. There aren't any wolves, as far as I can remember, for a start. So, yes, it's low-hanging fruit, but you can also do it interestingly. It just depends how you do it.
And she has a go. I can just see Lucy tensing up here. She has a good pop at Angela Carter, which is a bit like having a go at the Pope in some ways, because I think in literary circles, Angela Carter is someone that you don't really mess with.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Angela Carter fell rather out of fashion after she died. So she died.
Yeah. She's been only been fairly recently sort of canonised.
In the 90s and early noughties, no one was really talking about Angela Carter. Perhaps in university departments, people like to write dissertations on her because, you know, she does lots of clever things.
She's interesting.
She's interesting. And I'm not particularly going to have a pop at Angela Carter here either. But it's actually only recently, and particularly since Edmund Gordon's excellent biography of her, they only appeared last year, and then with the biography came the reissue of lots of the books and stories. So she's having a bit of a moment at the moment. So it's a particularly interesting time for Claire Loudon
mount a defence of Angela Carter.
I think she's in this piece, she's a bit of a victim of her own success, because Claire Loudon is saying, oh, I'm fed up of wolves going before us and ravens and people looking in mirrors and a feather fluttering down. Absolutely fair enough. But that wasn't happening when Angela Carter did it
first.
Margaret Atwood did it. And when they did it, it was... Especially the kind of wolf and the woman and the radical thing. Now it seems a bit tired, you know, the wild beast and men want to tame women and animals, all of that. But it's only tired because she came up with it and everyone went, ooh, really? And looked at it differently. And I think that she can't be blamed for pale imitations of her work. And the same with Margaret Atwood. And I think they have inspired
She quotes Angela Carter a line, "The last thing the old lady saw in all this world was a young man, eyes like cinders, naked as a stone, approaching her bed. In all this world, eyes like cinders," says Claire Loudon. She compares it to two other authors. Carter is the sloppier, soppier writer. More wolves, yes, but more of the sentimental drivel too.
That's one sentence. Angela Carter, if you take the whole of her work, she's not sentimental and she's not sloppy. Sometimes she's terrifying. I mean, really terrifying, not in a kind of spooky fairy tale way.
So do you think that we should take adult fairy tales seriously, Toby? Because there's a case in here that also these things are better aimed at children. So you take Philip Pullman as an example, where they know their audience and they're written for a specific audience, and whereas adult fairy tales feel like just a spin-off in some ways.
Well, perhaps you have more freedom in writing for children in that respect. You don't have to constrain yourself with the notion of being literary or making...
The pressure's off.
And in a way that frees you up to perhaps be more... interesting with your fantasy figures and your creatures and your bestiary. So yes, I think to a certain extent that's right. But I don't think adult fairy tales are inherently silly. I'm not really sure anything's not fair game for fiction.
That's a fair point. Let's move to another type of fiction. Let's move on to Nordic noir. We had a piece on it in our Cheltenham edition last year by Ursa Sigurdardóttir. It's pretty well pronounced.
There's no one here who can do any better than that, I feel. That was lovely.
And she reflects, she's one of the great practitioners of it. She reflected on its rise in popularity, and it's even given rise to things like tartan noir or sunshine noir, I learned in the piece today. What's going on? Is Nordic noir now just a very well-established thing?
Yes, it is. What's going on to a certain extent is marketing. We like things to be neatly packaged. If our genre fiction has another kind of element of genre to it, the genre of place, that helps to sell things as well. So you have Mediterranean noir, there's a lot of Italian noir. We had quite a nice piece a few weeks ago by Joseph Farrell about the Italian detective genre and how Italy is the new Wild West, that sense of lawlessness. Nordic noir is very different, obviously.
What do you think the attraction is?
The attraction, well... what is Nordic noir to start with? I mean, it's obviously its place, it's dark forests and snow and things like that. It is the whole social ethos of those Nordic countries. So it's basically about the welfare state and bad things happening. We don't expect all these nasty things to happen in these wonderfully egalitarian societies like Sweden and Iceland. And yet, when nasty things do happen, and it's not just a case of people being murdered, it's corruption, it's the difficulties of multiculturalism, globalisation and immigration brushing up against these formerly very, very homogenous societies, we get a nice discord, and that creates interesting fiction.
And I think that's true. The genre fiction generally, I'm very fond, as you know, of sort of American crime writing, sort of James Ellroy and Elmore Leonard and Joseph Rumbo. And I suppose the attraction, I was trying to think of why do I like it? And the idea, I suppose, is it's a satisfactory narrative conclusion in a world that has no satisfactory narrative conclusions. That's the pleasure you get with a genre novel. You kind of know what you're getting. So the snowiness, I suppose, of Nordic noir, you know you're going to get a certain amount of things you're familiar with, and it's probably going to come right with a click like a closing box at the end of it.
Yes, there's a comfort in that. And we read a lot of that kind of fiction for comfort. Back to the fairy tales, for example, I mean, you know, tired tropes of snow and forest, it seems to work better in detective thrillers when we're reading it to expect certain things, rather than perhaps in more, in inverted commas, literary updatings of fairy stories where we want to be challenged a bit more, perhaps.
Or whereas fairy tales proclaim their own inventiveness as a benefit, whereas a genre novel does the exact opposite.
Yes.
It says, well, please welcome me in, you know what you're going to get.
Exactly, and then once you're in, you can then play with things and be interesting in different ways.
I think, I mean, in some way they give you the pleasure of something like a crossword or a puzzle as well. You know what the deal is, you're going to work through a process and it's going to be okay. You know, it will be worked out in the end, as you say.
Do you think that television and film have also cemented this? Because I've actually not watched very much Nordic noir, but I'm familiar with the bridge and I'm familiar with the visuals that are attached to it, and there was the Stieg Larsson stuff as well, which was
and
both
the killing.
The European film and an American film, wasn't it, as
yes.
well? So it's sort of passed away, it's passed out of literary culture into mainstream pop culture. Is that a benefit, do you think? Is that sort of fixed it in everyone's minds more?
I think to a certain extent, yes, and I'm sure that if you're not naturally drawn to literature, but you got very into some of the TV series, you might be more likely to pick up one of the books, which is great. I think a lot of the literature is better than the TV. The Killing, for example, I mean, I loved watching it, but it was completely ludicrous. I think there's a website that's devoted to the 73 plot flaws in The Killing, all of which are completely true. Any one of these things, you know, could actually undermine the entire series.
And is that true of these books, in the ones you've read? Do you read them, Lucy, by the way?
I'm afraid I don't. And
you
no,
don't
I haven't read any
you?
Of that. I don't like... Don't show me up. No, the only ones... I don't have much of a stomach for the... frankly endless killing and torturing of young women that seems to go on. Don't want to get too
well, no, that's interesting,
because I do find it does happen a lot.
Yeah, there is a bit of that, and The Killing was certainly guilty of that. I like from the little I've read, I'm going to show myself out with my pronunciation, I'll be Indrid Aftsson, so Sigurdsdóttir's Icelandic colleague, and one of his books, Jar City, was turned into a fantastic noirish film as well, so I thoroughly recommend that.
It's interesting though that the practitioners of this are women as well, as it
absolutely they are, and I think some of the more ghoulish ones and also
the detectives themselves are women.
I'm not saying that it's all kind of dictated by men. I mean, it's clearly not, but I find that on the things on TV as well, the ones that I like, there's which is a woman, but she writes as Fred Vargas, French. And she does sort of detective fiction, and those are lovely. There has to be a bit of kind of jeopardy and violence killing. I mean, you know, fair enough. But they're very nicely worked out, and they're all constantly drinking white wine and kind of quoting fine literature and stuff. It sounds unbearable, but it's brilliant, actually.
Yeah, Fred Vargas.
Yeah, it's really good.
I presume they're playing off that anyway in this, as we say, the Scandinavian thing. They come from a very egalitarian society, often quite a proto-feminist societies, these Scandinavian societies. So the fact that there are women in jeopardy is probably a deliberate thing, because they're trying to create unease, aren't they, with these books?
Yeah, exactly. It's unexpected.
We're going to talk about one other thing, because Robert Irwin, in the paper this week, makes the case for The Man on a Donkey by H.F.M. Prescott, which is a novel about the pilgrimage of Grace in Tudor times, as the greatest ever historical novel, he says, in terms. I'm reading it now. It's very nice. I'm not sure. It's quite beautifully written, but it's relatively sedate. It didn't strike me, I'm only on page 30 or something, as the greatest ever historical novel. So I thought we might finish this part on our own recommendations for the greatest ever, as Robert Irwin says, the greatest ever historical novel. His is The Man on a Donkey. Toby Lichtig, what is yours?
I always shrink slightly when I'm asked to say my best or favourite or greatest or anything, but here I am and I'm being put on the spot. I mean, perhaps Middlemarch. I mean, it is essentially a historical novel. It was written in the 1870s.
Are we going to allow this?
Nice.
Well, it was written in the 1870s, but it's set 50 years previously.
But it's not about
But it very, very cleverly reflects on and evokes a time, and as far as I'm concerned, that's what historical novel does. So another one I was actually thinking of was The Leopard, The Gattopardo. It was published in the 50s, set about 50, 60 years previously, and again, it does that thing. But, having said that, I think my favourite historical novel is possibly The Rasetsky March by Joseph Roth, which is absolutely fantastic.
Yes.
And I noticed all these ones that I like seem to be set a generation before the writer. There must be something about that.
And they're somehow not self-declared historical novels. They're not genre novels.
They're not genre novels, no.
So I wonder whether that's the case, that a genre novel necessarily kind of limits its quality to a certain extent.
And if I may be greedy, I was thinking about this as well. And
that's four.
Sorry. Oh, no, sorry. Like I said, I don't
okay. Just say.
I've got seven.
I don't like these top ones.
Yeah, no.
I seem to have a predilection for what I can only call the fictional historical autobiography. So basically, we're talking about I, Claudius. We're talking about we're talking about Margaret Yourcenar, memoirs of Emperor Hadrian. Yeah. Which is fantastic.
I would give a vote for that one.
It's hard to go past. Hard to go past I, Claudius. I've read I, Claudius about 15 times.
Love
I think
it.
Memoirs of Hadrian is
it's fantastic.
Magic,
have you read Memoirs of Hadrian?
I'm not sure I have.
So
you must
good.
Do. You'll love
I
it.
Really, yeah. I love a bit of classical.
If you love Claudius, you will love Hadrian.
I quite like Count Belisarius actually, which is Robert Graves' other historical novel, which is set in the sort of as the decline of the Roman Empire in Britain.
Right. I don't know that.
I'll read that. Hadrian.
Okay, Lucy, that's really good then. I'll try that. Yeah, lovely. Go on. The greatest ever, not your favourite, the greatest ever historical novel. Challenge Robert Irwin.
I'm not going to do the greatest ever, I'm going to do my favourite, if that's all right.
Fine.
Greatest ever, sorry, War and Peace, but I'll shut up now.
Yeah, yeah. Stop saying literary novels and then pretending it's a historical
also
novel.
Also, mine are not as highbrow.
No, exactly. I know. We all know what Toby's doing. He's doing literary virtue signal. to a colossal extent. Go on.
I am going to say, I just can't think of anything much better than The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas.
Good for you.
It's just so
good.
Make
the case, why?
Because it's such good fun. It's completely absorbing. It's the kind of, I don't know, I can't really make a very coherent literary case for it because there might not be one, I don't know. I'm very fond of him in general.
Well, I think there's a certain pleasure in the highest level of literary hackdom. So it's clearly a genre novel. He clearly was a hack.
Sort of invented the genre, so he gets more points.
Well, he does.
Just him and Walter Scott. He basically saw what Walter Scott was doing and went, oh, that's good.
And did it a lot better.
And he said, I think I'll teach the French about their entire history, and then did it.
And just sort of churned it out.
Yeah. I mean, in between doing countless other things as well. And it's just, and they get increasing, because there's three parts.
I know.
And the first one, I know you've read it too. The first one is very rollicking. And
it is good.
You know, thigh slapping and brilliant.
I like the second one, 30 years after.
And the 20 years after, I think. But they get more complex, and then by the end, you're really involved with them.
You
and they're old men, and it's kind of heartbreaking.
And there's a fantastic moment in 20 years after where they try and rescue King Charles I from being executed.
Absolutely.
And even though you know,
aren't they lying underneath?
They're lying underneath the scaffold,
and some of
and
his blood falls on this. It's D'Artagnan, is it?
It is.
Or Athos, I can't remember.
I think it's him and Athos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even though you know that Charles I does get executed,
you're really going, maybe
like,
they'll do it, it's the Musketeers.
and they don't. Right, we've got to finish, but I'm going to say I'm staying in France. I don't think you'd heard of this, but someone recommended this to me. These are fantastic. It's called The Iron King. And it's a series of six novels by Maurice Druon. And it's set at the beginnings of the Hundred Years' War. The first book's about Philip the Fair being cursed for his persecution of the Knights Templar. George R. R. Martin, who I do not like as a writer, says it's the original Game of Thrones. Mm. It is fantastically violent, cold-blooded, Machiavellian, uber-high politics. It's quite shockingly done. It's beautifully written, or at least the translation is beautiful. Lucy, you could read it in the original French.
Maybe I could.
The Iron King. Maurice, have you heard of it?
Good. No, it sounds great,
No, I
though.
Haven't. I mean, you mentioned it before, but no, I haven't.
Check it out. Everyone should check it out. Maurice Druon, The Iron King.
And when was it written? When was
he wrote it in the 50s. And I think in France it's been televised numerous times. I think it's quite a big thing in France, and it's kind of not really crossed over. There's beautiful new editions of it. They've just republished all of them, and they're really attractive looking things. So, well, there we go. Don't say this podcast is not useful. That's recommendations ahoy for everybody.
It's so useful. It's like a spanner or a loaf of bread.
What better? Should we put that on the advert? Like a spanner or a loaf of bread.
It's as useful as.
Well done. Well done.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In the arts pages of the TLS this week, though, we've got something of a theatre extravaganza. We've got Jez Butterworth at the Royal Court, which we'll talk about with Toby Lichtig, who's still here with us. Martin Crimp at the Almeida, Brecht at the Donmar, and Tony Kushner at the National, or rather back at the National. Hal Jensen went along to see this for us and sat through 8 hours of theatre in one day, so he gets the Stamina Award this week, certainly.
Strong and stable.
Certainly stable, we hope, and we hope strong as well. Angels in America was written when the AIDS crisis was still unfolding in the early 1990s, and it first showed at a tiny theatre in San Francisco and then gathered momentum till it opened on Broadway and then in London, previously at the National. It's a huge play, I think I'm right in saying, yes, in scope and ambition, and the subtitle, as you remind us, Hal, is a gay fantasia on national themes. Do you think it was, and possibly is, so successful because it tackled not only AIDS but also sort of everything else?
The initial interest will have been the AIDS epidemic, because clearly at the time when he wrote it, he started writing it in 1987, I mean quite early on, and it took a while to devise and develop, and he workshopped it. But still, it was premiered in 1992, and it was still an enormous crisis.
Yeah, sure.
People watching it then would have had a different reaction, I think, to people watching it now. I think your age makes a difference when you're watching this revival. But the national issues are the ones that kind of allow it to carry on now, I think. The fact he puts the kitchen sink in there, I mean, he really does try and address everything metaphysical, yes, in the play. And the AIDS epidemic is the crisis upon which
What are the national themes?
Well, there's four main strong characters with their voices coming through, and it is about trying to find your identity, which in this case with the American theme seems to be quite a national. You have to have a national aspect to your identity, which means you define perhaps with Republican or not with Republican, and you don't just rely on your personal stories. You seem to incorporate either perhaps your religion or whatever it is.
Yeah, so there's a Mormon character, two Mormon characters.
Two Mormon, Mormon, right? And his wife and his mother.
Three Mormon characters.
Yes,
there we go. Yeah.
And does Trump loom? Does Trump loom large?
Is this no, he doesn't really. And they certainly
which is,
don't.
Which is good in a way, isn't it?
Cause yeah, they certainly don't bring it out. It clearly looms if you know your history. You know that Roy Cohn, who is a character in the play, was a sort of mentor to Trump, and there are similarities between the two of them, obviously, in their sort of monstrousness.
Well, tell us about him, because I didn't know anything about him. He's played by Nathan Lane, isn't he?
Yes, very well indeed. In fact, he captures or channels monstrousness particularly well. He was a notoriously sort of malevolent lawyer all the way through the 50s to the 80s, really. He was part of the McCarthy investigations. Wow. He was a prosecutor.
He was Trump's senior lawyer, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he the full extent of their relationship is probably still not quite known, apparently. But still, it doesn't actually impinge. You don't watch the plays thinking, what a marvellously relevant play because of Trump. It's not really... No. It really does. That would be a bit feeble for 8 hours. You don't need all that. It's much more to do with the individuals finding their identity, really.
And he dies of AIDS. He dies,
which he did in real life in 1986.
And I'm interested, does that in any way soften your view of him? Does he become a martyr in a sense?
I mean, clearly the character in the play isn't quite the man in real life, I don't think, because certainly all we see him from the very beginning when he's both diagnosed with AIDS and when he's being disbarred. But all the way up to then in his life, he'd been triumphant and trodden over everyone else. But we don't get that in the play. We just get the moment from which he's on the back foot and resisting it all. His ego is massive and he's resisting it all. And you can't help but sympathise with someone who is pushed into that corner and is trying to defy the world and reality. It's very clever, I think, the way Kushner gets us to identify with that ego element of him. We don't come out thinking, what a marvellous man he might have been. I mean, there isn't any of that, but it's amazing how quickly you warm to... So certainly Nathan Lane's portrayal, where he gets the virtuoso evil element to him in the first scene particularly. So we're sort of trapped. We're not allowed to hate him, which is the easy thing to do.
Is it moving?
It's exhausting, obviously, and that's part of what it is. It drains you watching 8 hours. You don't have to watch the two on the same day, which I did, but I think there's something about that full eight-hour journey that works. Deliberately sprawls, it deliberately refuses to come to a proper single conclusion, and they're all looking to get to the threshold of revelation, these people, and it feels as though Kushner's saying, in order to get there, it's a bit of a hard journey, there's no easy route and I'm not going to give you one. He gives us all a blessing at the end. The main character turns around and offers a blessing to the audience. It's written in the play, he offers this blessing. More life is what it is.
But not religious, isn't it?
No, he says, I bless you, and says more life. I think, is that the literal Hebrew meaning of blessing?
Yes,
more life.
Yeah.
I think, again, if you're in 1992 listening to that, there might be an element of hopeful defiance or something about it, whereas now it feels quite a genial kind of, you know, benediction from Andrew Garfield who plays this main character for the rest of us.
Because I was wondering, because you talk about in your piece as well, whether this, because you contrast it with My Night with Reg by Kevin Elliott, which is much quieter and more formal.
Bit of chamber music, really.
Yes,
yeah.
And are we allowed to say more English? Or
yes,
shall I not
I
say
think
that?
It's very
English.
At risk
of stereotyping us and them.
You know, these happen to fit those stereotypes,
yes.
I think.
It's
focused, it's nuanced, it's quiet, it takes place in one sitting room. It certainly does come to a conclusion, and it comes to quite a sad conclusion. It doesn't give us more life, and at the end, Reg isn't there, and other people have died in the play, and that's it. Whereas Kushner gives us this whole horrible story in many ways. I mean, really puts us through it and puts the characters through it. And then at the end says, if you wanted a silly version of it, really, it would be Dory in Finding Nemo. It's sort of just keep swimming. that's the sort of philosophy it comes,
really?
Comes down
going.
To. But
yeah.
It's the experience of watching it is what really, really counts. And that's this sort of... makes you face certain truths and what makes you watch people taking their deceptions down and being confronted with their, you know, false selves which they've created throughout their lives. And it sort of requires that extent.
That's what I was wondering. Do you think, because also there was I haven't seen it myself, that there's quite a big difference between the first play and the second, that the first is much more tightly controlled and works as a play on its own, whereas the second is much more sprawling and kind of all over the place.
Definitely true. Tightly controlled, it's still 3.5 hours
yes,
long.
Sure.
Normal plays go,
relatively,
it's still quite long.
Yeah.
But it leads up to the point where the angel arrives, the messenger from the heavens arrives to tell Pryor, who's the lead character, that he's the prophet. But it takes 3.5 hours to get us there. Everyone's been given this crisis, they start reacting to it, we watch them trying to defend themselves against it. But actually, it's weird, you reach the end of 3.5 hours and something begins rather than ends, and
so
the angel arrives,
what's next?
And you sort of get ready for part two, which then doesn't give you a resolution. It just goes in all directions. You watch people falling apart, and then it does try this neat little benediction at the end, which is directed at the audience, to see if we can kind of leave with some kind of consolation, I think, because otherwise you just go there thinking, the angels might be right, because the angels in this play, their view is stasis is the answer. Every time we try progress as humanity, we bring disaster to the world. Right. So the only thing we can do at the moment is press pause, and we have to stop. And Pryor, played by Andrew Garfield, who's the lead, refuses to take on this prophet's role. He decides that life, right, however horrible, is the only way you can get hope, yeah, and stasis isn't the answer.
I'm struck by this is a big national play taking on a national subject. Toby, you're listening to this. You saw The Ferryman by Jez Butterworth, which is about Ireland, isn't it?
It's about the Troubles. Compared to Howl's Happy Ordeal, it's the equivalent of a Beckett short. It was a mere 3 hours at the Royal Court.
I want to get to the end of this, your view on how long a play should be, because to me, this I don't want to sit at a play for 3.5 hours, generally speaking.
8 hours.
8 hours. Iron bottom over there.
Are you
sensing a parallel here that this is is Jez Butterworth a big statement play about the state of a nation?
Yes,
at the time?
It is. Jez Butterworth, actually, he's been knocking around for quite a long time, but it was really Jerusalem that was his complete sort of coming out play, where suddenly it was selling out, it got these huge transfers, it got rave reviews, it is fantastic. And then he went quiet for a bit, and there's only been one play until now since then, which is called The River, and it was a short play, an hour, you'd have liked it for that length alone. Yeah. Which was about 4 or 5 years ago, and now he's suddenly come back, and it's a proper socio-political psychodrama extravaganza, kind of family conflict set against the backdrop of the Troubles. It's Northern Ireland, it's the early 1980s, it's the hunger strikers, Bobby Sands, all that stuff's going on in the background, but it's set in this farmhouse in, kind of rural County Armagh.
Which he does, doesn't he? He often places these things in these bucolic settings.
It's what he does, and what he's very, very good at is mining the opposition between the sort of the bucolic and the rural and the familial and the domestic, and also, by implication, the sort of folkloric and ritualistic and ancient, and then the sort of gritty, urban, gangsterish, political, contemporary turmoil or reason, historical turmoil of a particular time that brushes up against it, and how these two things interact with each other.
And is this, I want to ask the same question of Hal, actually, this is a period piece. Is this a piece that is basically set in a specific period and therefore is judged as a period piece, or is it? Does it feel like this is a prism through which we're supposed to be considering?
I think it's a prism, and actually, by happy, and I put the word happy in inverted commas, coincidence. It's about Northern Ireland, it's about the Troubles, and that's suddenly become very relevant again because of Brexit. And I don't imagine Jez Butterworth particularly had that in mind when he started writing the play. I don't know, but Ireland is a perennial problem, and also the issues it deals with about loyalty to the state and loyalty to family and loyalty to political cause. They are timeless, and it's not necessarily just about Northern Ireland. And if this play does last and is staged in 100, 200 years' time, I'm sure people will find ways of updating it accordingly.
But this, what you saw Hal, is more a revival of a piece that was probably doing that at the time.
But it's very specific to its time in one sense, but it doesn't date, I don't think.
Is it not?
The references are there. So you've got Roy Cohn, obviously, and the references to Reagan, and the second play is called Perestroika, so man, there are echoes there, but it's not what the play is about. What was going on in the 80s is not journalistic, the way it approaches it, so it's not trapped by it.
And it's interesting what you're saying about it being kind of written and rewritten and redevised. It did take years, didn't it?
Yeah, I think he always conceived it as one large two-part play,
yeah,
but having got the first part done, which does have a slightly tighter focus to it, mm-hmm, the second part could almost have been anything, and I think he's adapted it even since the 1992 premiere. He's done little fiddlings,
but as it was being written, the crisis, the ongoing crisis, was changing and developing and worsening.
Yeah, it's still bad for a long time.
He went, I'll write about AIDS, the AIDS crisis, because now we've sorted it.
It was interesting.
It was absolutely happening,
in the audience. There
it?
Were people who clearly wouldn't have been born in the late 80s, early 90s, who were watching this, for whom that wouldn't have been a resonant thing, really. Whereas there were people, you get to know your row very intimately during this evening, because there are lots of intervals, and there are people in my row who are in over 50, I'm not, and they were sort of shocked out the first two intervals. They were quite shocked because they were coming out, they were just being reminded totally, taken straight back to that time, and quite sort of startled and stunned by what it brought out, because it was such a fearful... We didn't know how long it was going to know. We could put it historically.
Well, is that true of Ireland as well? I'm interested in that because, I talk to people on the radio show that I have that where Ireland, the Troubles, doesn't mean very much to them. It's a thing that a lot of people grew up with. But if you're under 30, you didn't really necessarily grow up hugely with it.
I think if you're under 30
question.
In Londonderry, or Derry, depending on which port. Don't worry, I'm taking care of both of those. Depending on what sort of divide you lie on, and I lie on neither. I think you do. Perhaps not if you grew up in London, though, and you weren't subjected to IRA terrorism or whatever.
Mm. So how does this feel?
Or freedom fighting, depending on which part of the divide you come from.
It's still terrorism, I think, whatever else you want to call it. It must still be terrorism. But does this feel like something that needs to be re-brought to people's attention? Or is it just, why has he done this? Has he got a political point to make? Because there's a clear purpose to the play that Hal's talking about. What's the purpose of this one?
I think he's got less of a political point to make than the play Hal saw, and that's partly because, you know, he's also writing historically. He wrote this over the last 2 or 3 years, but he set it 30 years ago, whereas, you know, your one was kind of being set as it was being written. I think he's using the politics as a backdrop, and so I think it's a convenient way of looking at, you know, it's not necessarily about the Troubles. Yes, there are a few specific things, and there's Maggie Thatcher on the radio talking about the hunger strikers and her disdain for them, but it doesn't necessarily have to just be about that. So I think it's probably less political in a sense.
We have to wrap this up. I'm just interested, you mentioned if this was staged in 100 years' time, how they would do it. Do you think how important are these plays? Are these significant plays that will stand the test of time? And I suppose, to begin with, how Angels in America has stood the test of time in the sense that it's now 20 years on.
That's true. It's really hard to predict, isn't it, with these, what people will be wanting to watch. I mean, in terms of, does it still work as a play? It works. I mean, whether it's important, it's not as important now, perhaps, as it was then, or the impact is slightly less, but it still works. And the acting is very, very good. And so there's a lot to enjoy. I mean, there is a lot.
And Jez Butterworth?
Yes, to a certain extent. I think he is. I think you could probably call him one of our major playwrights. I don't think this is as good as Jerusalem. So, you know, if any of him survives and it's just one play, it's probably going to be that so far. But I do think it's a big, powerful play, and it'll certainly get restaged. And it's already going to get a West End transfer, and it'll no doubt end up on Broadway. And yeah, I think it'll certainly last for a while.
Well, it's nice that that two decent plays and. That you can go and see. I think the hit rate of plays,
unlike the last one I sent you to, which you didn't like at all.
No, Romeo and Juliet. Well,
the last one you sent me to as well, The Kid Stays in the Picture, which was extremely disappointing.
No, didn't like that one.
I agree with you.
Sent me to this, and that's fine.
Yeah. I don't often find myself heartily recommending plays. No, and I would say shell out the money and go and see this.
Well, that's as good as it can get, I think. That's all we've got time for this week. Our thanks very much go to Toby Lichtig, Hal Jensen, and Sudhir Hazara Singh, and of course to the Northerner of the week, Lucy Dallas. Have you had fun?
Oh, so much fun. Northerner of the week, I'm not sure about, but let's...
You're not up against very much competition here.
not in this current studio, no.
But outside. I think the award also works outside as well. Do go to the -tls.co.uk to see this week's edition of the paper, which has a wonderful image drawn by our resident artist Darren Smith on the cover of a wolf, and includes a lovely feature on the novelist Molly Keane, some fine American history on flooding, the CIA's contamination of literary journalism, and the birth of the FBI. You can tweet this podcast at @FBFM_podcast with your comments and suggestions. Next week, Thea will be returning for a philosophy special show where Tim Crane, our philosophy editor, will be back, as he promised, to solve the mind-body problem once and for all. How could you miss that? Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.